Hey, welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Devin.
And Devin's still a Gryffindor.
I am still a fucking Gryffindor, thank you.
We got a lot of feedback on our Harry Potter discussion.
We really did.
And we'll get into that in our actual listener feedback section. But there were people who were like, we could like listen to you guys, to your friends talk about Harry Potter for a while.
I know.
Which don't encourage us.
Yeah, right?
We will. We absolutely will.
Yeah. No shame in that Harry Potter game.
None at all. Okay, but we have a packed show today.
We do.
So we're not going to bullshit at the top like we usually do.
Right, we usually
just get down to
talk
business.
About bullshit for like 2 minutes. Yeah. Fuck it.
But so we're going to go through what we're going to discuss today. So of course we always start with listener feedback and updates, and you know there's some Harry Potter bullshit in there. Our second block is Devin has taken some liberty to sort of rename our perma block.
Yeah.
She's calling it Russia Trump Land Bullshit Nibbles. Which sounds like a really fucked up cat food.
Right. I was just going to say cereal, but yeah, cat
like
food's better.
You're double agent cat. Like, that's the food. You're double agent cat.
I'm a spy kitty.
Yeah, a spy kitty. Anyway, our third block is our interview with my friend Syra Hussein, who is a lawyer, and she does really cool shit around immigrant rights.
She also might be the baddest bitch.
Yeah, she is amazing.
She's amazing.
She's really amazing. We already talked to her, and we really enjoyed the discussion, and we think you friends will too. After that, we have our gratitude check, always necessary and needed. Then, you know, since it's Thursday, we get into our Maxine Waters update and Maxine Waters award and badassery. And then finally, we have some action items. And Syra, who is the person we interviewed, she has an action item for you friends. And that was really fun to record with her. Okay, Devin, let's get into some listener feedback and general Hellbent updates. So what's the first bit of feedback that we have?
So we got a lot of feedback on the episode length.
Right, because we were asking you friends how you felt about some of our longer episodes, because we feel a little, you know, self-conscious about it.
Right, especially because on Monday we ran a lot longer than we normally do.
Right, right.
We had a lot to talk
about. We try to keep it at like 1:05.
Yeah.
And we went to like 1:20.
Yeah.
Which is usually our Thursday length because we have our interview.
But anyway, so Rainu said, one, talk all you want. We love the info and F words. Two, shout out to Renee for her work. I have the trifecta of dickwads in Kentucky. Indivisible is keeping us moving.
Nice.
So, nice little shout out there.
Yes. And then Nora said, hey, I will listen to you talk as long as you want to. A 2-hour podcast would make me squee with joy. And then we actually also got a message on Twitter. Uh-huh. And I forget her handle, but she said, if you did it every day, I would love it. She's like, I know this is not like a full-time job.
Right, right. That is the dream though.
But then we had, and then Spirit also said yes to longer podcasts and maybe a Harry Potter minisode, which
do not encourage us.
Don't give us ideas. Maybe for Patreon we'll do that. But then Rachel said, re-podcast length when I don't finish in 3 subway rides to Dennis to work and home. And I asked, you know, how long is that? She said 1:10. Mm. So she said, when I don't finish in 3 subway rides, that does feel a little too long.
Yeah.
So good to know.
Good to
we
know.
Do try to keep it around that.
Yeah, we 70 or 75 minutes is like our absolute like high mark.
Again, we make no promises because Trump is president, but we appreciate the feedback.
Yes.
And we will definitely keep that in mind. So speaking of Harry Potter.
Yeah, everyone loves fucking Harry Potter.
Of course.
So Sam said, Sarah Lerner, you rage Slytherin tweeting at the GOP. What, and she said, like,
Was fire,
basically.
Yeah, so if you're on Patreon, you know that I sort of talked about the way we framed our latest episode in a tweet. I said, I basically told the GOP to go fuck themselves.
Right.
Like, I tagged them. I was very aggressive.
Yeah.
And I was like, I told Devin, I went full fucking Slytherin.
Well, yeah, we're like, we're tagging you. We would like you to come for us. Like, I will put you in your place.
Yeah, so Sam enjoyed that. So thank you. Shannon.
Okay, I'm going to take this one. So Shannon said, shaking my head with the terrible Harry Potter hot takes, Ron is useless. Okay, listen, I know we said that, but in my defense.
I said that.
Sarah said that. And in my defense, Ron was the first boy I ever wanted to marry.
Yeah.
Like, very seriously. Yeah. And I do not think he's useless in the books, but movie Ron is a little useless.
Yeah, so we had some pushback on Twitter on that as well. People felt pretty strongly.
Pretty strongly.
You know what? I stand by my Ron hot take.
Of course
I stand
do.
By it, and no one can convince me otherwise.
Slytherin as fuck.
He's fucking useless. And then Nick also, speaking of Slytherin as fuck, Nick said, Sarah Lerner's I'm Slytherin as fuck is my new personal mantra. You don't have to be evil to be Slytherin. You can just be crafty, damn it.
Yeah.
Which I agree. Like, you know, we think of Slytherin as like all out evil.
Right.
But there are some, you know, good Slytherins.
Yeah. And also, this isn't the like Harry Potter era anymore. This is the new Slytherin.
Right. Exactly. Like the rebranded Slytherin.
Right. Like Scorpius Malfoy. And if you don't know what I'm talking about,
I don't know what you're
I don't know.
About.
Oh, God.
And then some random tidbits we got. So moving on from Harry Potter, because we could talk about that for a while. Sarah said, just had time to listen to yesterday's episode. Wanted to share how much I love the disdainful way both of you say Putin. Which I didn't know we said it any which way, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
Because he fucking hacked our fucking democracy.
And I'm kind of pissed.
And I'm a little pissed.
I'm a little mad about it.
I'm going to bear that grudge for a while.
Midwest Maelstrom said, Hellbent is like if my innermost feelings became sentient and started a podcast. They get me. Hashtag dickwads beyond. Hashtag fuck this shit. Which, yeah, I love that.
It's like our innermost feelings became a podcast. So we agree.
We agree.
And then finally, along this vein, Court said, never gave, quote, guys much thought until recently. Last night I realized I now come home and say, hi, friends, to my dogs. I love that
I
so
love
much.
That. That's great.
So cute. And then we had, we just wanted to share this from the Facebook group.
Yes.
A woman named Amanda, via her friend, had a really great bit about self-care, because
right.
we talked about that in our last podcast.
And burnout,
especially if you live in really conservative areas. So Amanda said, self-care discussion. I was reminded of advice I got from an old friend. She reminded me of the technique we use in choir. When a piece does not offer many rests, the individual voices stagger their breaths so the music continues unbroken. This is how we must approach activism. We must support each other by keeping our voices strong, take a breath when we need it, trust our sisters to continue, and come back strong to let the next voice breathe. This is how we make beauty instead of noise. Which I was like, wow.
Yeah.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, and
such
powerful.
A great way to put it.
Yeah.
And, you know, like we said last week, you know, self-care is a political act.
It is.
And that came up in our discussion with Brittany Packnett.
Yeah.
And it is very important, especially in these trying times.
It definitely
I just
is.
Love the way Amanda put that.
Mm-hmm.
So moving on to Hellbent updates.
Merch.
We get so weird around merch.
I love it.
But take it away, Devin.
Okay, so the shop is back up. As of, like, this listening, it will be back up. And then we have It's Always Both merch coming soon.
Yes.
That's next up on the plate. And then the June sale on the selected Local Politics is Sexy shirts is extended through July 9th. Also, I wanted to say, we got some feedback about Local Politics is Sexy versus Local Politics are Sexy.
Oh.
So the reason I say is sexy is because I was taking Local Politics as like
an entity. A singular
like a
thing.
Set.
Yeah.
But technically, grammatically, it would be are sexy.
Yeah.
Local Politics are sexy.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It made me think, which hurt. So
which
I don't know.
Hurt. That's a good point.
Yeah.
I thought of it as sort of an entity too.
Right.
Okay. So we'll get back to
you
friends
on that.
That's a good thing to keep in mind.
Yeah.
And then some general updates on us. We love all the positive feedback on iTunes. It like really feeds our soul, and it would mean a lot if you took a minute to rate us 5 stars. That's just like the rules of feminism.
Exactly.
Right?
Like that's just you have to be a feminist.
You have to. That you have to rate our podcast 5 stars
to be a feminist.
That's the rules.
Also. Kind of exciting.
Yes.
Sarah and I are taking next week off.
What?
I know. Since it's the 4th of July break, and I'm going to Tennessee for something called Handy Palooza, which I cannot make up. It is real.
It's a thing.
I mean, honestly, we're still going to be like reading political analysis and refreshing Twitter.
But
look, we have lives.
Yeah. We thought about maybe doing an episode with Devin in Tennessee, and I was like, listen, you enjoy your shit.
Yeah.
I've also had a hard week or so with headaches, so we figured that was a good time to just take a break.
Right.
But we'll be back after that.
Yes.
So appreciate, you know, you feeling okay with us taking a break?
I know, right?
please don't leave us.
Don't leave.
And then finally, our newsletter. So it usually comes out the first Tuesday of the month. But again, since we're off next week and it's 4th of July and all that stuff, it'll come out the following week. So July 11th. So you can sign up at hellbentpodcast.com/newsletter. All right, Devin, let's get into our modified permablock, which is Russia, Trumpland, bullshit nibbles.
The cat food.
which we've decided is a hypothetical double agent cat's food.
Which sounds like a show my son would totally watch.
I would watch it, yeah, right? To be honest.
Let's be real.
Okay, so our first story is new and interesting ways to violate the Constitution, the domestic emoluments clause.
Yeah, which is a thing.
Which is a thing. So, yeah, break it down for us, Devin.
Okay, so first of all, Trump threw a fundraiser for his reelection campaign.
I still haven't gotten over how bananas that is.
I know. So he did it at his DC hotel, the Trump International, which is at the old post office.
Mm.
So he brought in $10 million 40 months ahead of the next election. 40 months. So never mind actually governing or dealing with Russian interference or, you know, anything. Let's go fuck around and get money for an election while only 5 months into this disastrous term.
I mean, it makes sense. He, like, loves, like, you know, attention and adoration and, like, rallies.
Right.
You know? Well, like, he doesn't actually want to be president.
Well, right. I mean, fun fact, he's already spent 5 evenings prior to Wednesday night, which was the fundraiser, on the road at political rallies, always in states that supported him in November, and always in front of an audience that thousands of fans who are screened and selected by campaign aides.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So this is no longer autocracy adjacent. That's just autocracy. Like, handpicking people to, like, slather on adulation.
Can't they technically, like, decide who they want to let in?
They can. I mean, it feels very creepy.
It is creepy. I will say definitely the, you know, new and interesting ways to violate the Constitution definitely goes to the autocratic side more.
Right. Okay, it's not full on autocracy. I'm being dramatic.
Yeah. Sarah Kendzior would be like, all right, we're not quite there yet.
I know.
But it's shades, you know?
It's right. Well,
it's really scary.
I think that's why I keep sounding the alarm on this.
Right. And I remember from Carlos Maza from Vox. He produces some of my favorite videos around, like, media. And he was talking about, he did a video recently about backsliding.
Right.
And basically, the concept of, you know, you don't go from a democratic society to an autocratic one in, like, one fell swoop. It's
right.
Not like one big event. It's a slow erosion of norms.
Right.
Which we are seeing in real time.
Okay. So let's say it's not full autocracy, but it's getting scarier.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, they definitely are allowed to select who goes to these rallies, but that sort of, like, pulse of adulation just feels very not nice.
Yeah.
Not good.
But let's get into how this fundraiser and all this stuff violates the Constitution.
I'm so glad you asked. I have a whole thing on it.
You do.
Okay, so first of all, Trump's government staff was apparently helping with the fundraiser, raising questions about how the government's dollars are paying for what is effectively a campaign effort.
Right.
So,
which is a violation, which is a conflict of interest.
Right. So from NBC News, quote, government employees have inappropriately crossed over into campaign activities. Tax dollars may be subsidizing some aspects of campaign events. As a constant candidate, the president risks alienating Americans who did not vote for him.
Which he he's obviously doing. Like, he said, oh, I'll be a president for all Americans, but he doesn't give a fuck.
No, he doesn't.
And then Dan Scavino, who's his social media director, he's already been in hot water over sort of similar-ish conflicts of interest.
Right.
So he had called for the removal of a Republican representative who was critical of Trump. And then the Office of the Special Counsel wrote, Scavino has been advised that if in the future he engages in prohibited political activity while employed in a position covered by the Hatch Act, we will consider such activity to be a willful and knowing violation of the law.
Yeah.
But again, it's like, it's all about how we enforce it, right? Like, norms rely on good faith actors.
Right.
And these are not good faith actors.
Yeah, like, I can write all the strongly worded emails I want, and I do. But unless I follow that up with action, like, this is basically the equivalent of a strongly worded email.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, don't do that, Scavino.
Yeah.
Like, no.
But then also in 2012, sort of on a similar vein, Rens Priebus, who was then the head of the RNC, now he's Trump's chief of staff, he called out Obama for use of federal money to sponsor campaign events. So going back to that sort of campaign thing. Though, you know, Obama had responded that he was careful to reimburse the expenses from his campaign fund. But today with Trump, you know, so far no reimbursements to the Secret Service have shown up in FEC reports.
Right. So cool. The second problem is that Trump leases the land for his hotel from the federal government.
Is this the old post office building?
Yes, the old post office building.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, from ABC, I think they put it really nicely. Trump technically leases the hotel from the General Services Administration, and profits are supposed to go to an account of the corporate entity that holds the lease.
Mm.
It remains unclear what might happen to any profits from the hotel after Trump leaves office, whether they will be transferred to Trump at that time, which is enriching himself via the presidency.
Right.
So Norm Eisen, who was special counsel for ethics and government reform under the Obama administration, had a great thread about this little pickle Trump is in.
You like Richard Painter a lot.
I do.
I think Norm Eisen is in the same vein, like a great Twitter follow.
He is a great Twitter follow. He's always super smart and scathing and wonderful.
On point, yeah.
On point. So he said, quote, Trump hotel fundraiser is illegal. His benefiting from leasing this U.S. property violates the Domestic Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution. And the government's refusal to enforce hotel lease term, which prohibits him from operating hotel, also makes tonight an illegal emolument. So anytime he profits from the hotel, as he is doing tonight, he is violating the Domestic Emoluments Clause. Trump monetizes his office constantly, but tonight is a new low. He's collecting cash from being president, from his hotel, and from his party, all in violation of the Constitution. Maybe that's why he yanked the press pool at the last minute. Well, we see you in court, that is.
He's like, borrowing a line from the ACLU.
Yeah.
See you in court, motherfucker.
Yeah. I mean, motherfucker. But yeah, I mean, basically, and not only that, but he also, as the president, he's basically a walking advertisement for his properties, including the Trump Hotel.
I mean, every weekend he's going to a Trump golf property, like you said.
Yeah. So it's just, it's ridiculous. And
yeah. So it's just something, again, you know, Congress is supposed to be a check.
Right.
We talked about this on a previous podcast, how there are Democrats who are suing.
Right.
Basically on this premise that Congress is supposed to be a check, but in practice they're not being.
Right. So they're suing for standing.
And they're saying that Trump has to run by them. Like, this is more the foreign emoluments clause, but like gifts that he receives and that kind of stuff. So again, the court system might be our only fucking hope here.
Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're our only hope.
Federal courts, please.
Federal courts, you're our only hope.
Let's move on.
Yes.
We want to get into a story around the travel ban, which we talked about on Monday. The Supreme Court had basically ruled against all the lower courts.
Right.
There was some caveats there, but mostly it was sort of upholding the ban, at least for like a 90-day period, to sort of see if their vetting procedures, just to like evaluate that.
Right.
So they're going to rehear it in October when they're back from summer session.
But again, they said it hopefully is a moot point, because if it is just a 90-day review, by the time they come back, it really shouldn't be something they have to hear again. But that's on the side. So basically, so the Trump administration took this ruling and they set new visa rules for the six countries named in this travel ban. So these would take effect tonight, Thursday, at
8 p.m. Eastern time.
8 p.m. Eastern time. So visas that have already been issued will not be revoked. So that's something.
Yeah.
So then they kind of define bona fide relationship.
Which in our last podcast, we're like, what does this even mean?
Exactly. So they did like kind of expand on that. So a bona fide relationship with a family member is described as a parent, spouse, child, adult son or daughter, son-in-law, daughter-in-law, or sibling. But you'll notice that that leaves out grandparents, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, nieces, nephews, cousins, brothers-in-law, sisters-in-law, or fiancés.
Yeah, like domestic partners, maybe.
Right, and other extended family members. So, you know, it's really a very narrow scope that they're trying to narrow it. And then additionally, it said that journalists, students, workers, or lecturers who have valid invitations or employment contracts in the U.S. would be exempt from the ban. The exemption does not apply to those who seek a relationship with an American business or educational institution purely for the purpose of avoiding the rules, which is,
I mean,
Duh. I mean, obviously, that's what rules are, whatever.
And there are also exceptions for adopted children, children in need of urgent medical care, if they're traveling for a business with a recognized international business, if they're traveling for business with a recognized international business, or, like, strangely, if they're a legal resident of Canada.
Yeah, which I guess if they're an immigrant, if they're from one of these countries, but they legally reside in Canada.
They're not, like, a citizen of Canada.
They're not a citizen of Canada, but they can still come to the U.S.
Strange to specifically shout out Canada, but I wonder if there is, like, an agreement between the U.S. and Canada. So we don't
That's what I'm wondering. I thought that was really weird.
A strange caveat.
Yeah.
And yeah, the director of immigrant rights with the ACLU, Omar Jadwa, said, quote, initial reports suggest that the government may try to unilaterally expand the scope of the ban. For example, by arbitrarily refusing to treat certain categories of familial relationships as bona fide. So kind of like what we talked about earlier. These reports are deeply concerning. We are watching for official word. And also horrible, would-be immigrants from the six countries who won a coveted visa in the government's diversity lottery. So that's a program that randomly awards 50,000 green cards a year to people from countries with low rates of immigration to the U.S. So those people will also have to prove that they have a, quote, bona fide relationship within the U.S. or they're eligible or are eligible for another waiver or face being banned for at least 90 days.
So even if they won a green card in this lottery, they still face the 90-day travel ban unless they have a bona fide relationship with someone in the United States.
Yeah, so this is something we're obviously going to keep our eyes on.
Yes.
Our interview today with Syra touches on a lot of themes around immigration, so it feels an appropriate time to be, like, really delving deep into this.
Yes.
But yeah, again, it's going, like Devin said, it's going to take effect at 8 p.m. Eastern time tonight.
So 5 p.m.
I feel like it's just going to be another shit show.
It's going to be a shit show. 100% a
shit show. Like, I just don't think that they're going to execute on that in an effective way at all. And, well, obviously, I think it's bullshit.
Right. Well, and also, we saw the first time around, they executed it horribly.
Yeah.
And it was a mess.
Yeah.
So.
But who knows?
Who knows?
Okay, so let's finally move on to Russia nibbles.
Russia nibbles!
So, really quickly, Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. are apparently possible subjects for Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe into Russian money laundering.
Yeah, so this has to do with a relationship with a company called Bayrock and a former employee, Felix Sater, who was a mob informant and a felon, who claims ties to Russian intelligence.
Oh, wow.
So basically, the Trump children were involved with negotiations with Bayrock and Sater on real estate deals, though Trump always had the final say.
Mm.
But they're saying that they could be in hot water if they conducted business with Sater directly for themselves.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and Sater apparently has threatened to go public with a story that would expose Donald Trump's role in wrongdoing in Kazakhstan. Mm. So it's really an interesting story. Also, Felix Sater is a super interesting character who was part of a $40 million pump and dump fraud scheme with the Russian mob.
Oh, wow.
But he pled guilty. He didn't go to prison and became a confidential informant.
Yeah.
So it's very... And while he was a confidential informant, he was working with the Trump Organization.
Oh, he was working with them?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
He even carried Trump Organization business cards with his name and title on them.
Y'all, there's, like, too many coincidences here.
Yeah.
Another name for Devin's whiteboard.
I know, seriously.
Felix Sater. Let's move on to, we haven't heard from this dickwad in a while, but Carter Page pops up again.
Yeah.
He apparently did not join the lawyer party because when he was questioned by the FBI for over 10 hours in March, he didn't have an attorney present. Like, what?
Yeah, not the brightest bulb in the box.
I feel like, yeah, Carter Page and, like, Roger Stone, like, do you remember when he went after RVA Wonk on Twitter and called her, like, a stupid bitch?
Yes.
And, like, then sort of admitted a back channel,
her
quote-unquote perfectly legal back channel to Julian Assange. I think I quote tweeted, she was like, remember when Stone gets interviewed by the FBI, like, this shit, right?
Right.
And I was like, I hate misogyny, but I love that a man like Roger Stone got so tripped up by his that he, like, made this unforced error.
Right.
Like, I just...
we're not asking you that question, but thanks for that answer.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the questioning for Page was mostly about the Steele dossier, which had asserted that he was part of a, quote, well-developed conspiracy of cooperation between Trump associates and Russian leadership.
Right. So there was also claims that he met with Igor Sechin, the close associate of Putin, and senior Kremlin official Igor Devkin. So Page denies these allegations, but what I wouldn't give to get my hands on those transcripts.
Yeah. And then there's also a fascinating look at what Trump would have to do to fire Mueller.
Yeah, too long didn't read. That's gonna be fucking difficult.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not...
Well, who the fuck knows at this point?
I know. I mean, like, he has shirked so many norms at this point. But basically, so we'll put this article on our show notes.
It's definitely worth a read.
He'd have to get rid of Rosenstein. Then he would have to deal with Rachel Brand, who's number three at the DOJ, and then Dana Bente, who's number four. Neither of whom look like the type of people that would succumb to Trump's pressure, but again, you would never know. You never know these
never
days.
Know.
I mean, there's so many, like, reputations lost. Like, we need an in memoriam,
right,
of all the reputations,
like,
lost
at the Oscars.
Yeah, with, like, really sad music. And then he'd actually have to fill the positions at the DOJ with allies, get them through Senate confirmation hearings, and then he would have to fire Mueller. It's, like, a very long process, apparently.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not going to be easy. I mean, if you think back to Nixon with Saturday Night Massacre,
right,
he had to fire all these fucking people to find someone to fire the special counsel.
Right,
so,
right.
And then this piece notes, quote, firing Mueller will mark a new low in Trump's scorched earth attack on established norms and the rule of law.
And then finally, a bill could ban the Pentagon from doing business with Kaspersky, which is a Russian cybersecurity firm.
Yeah, so they create antivirus software and other, like, cybersecurity products. And then in light of the 2016 election, the intelligence community officials, they just don't trust this company,
mm-hmm,
citing an alarmingly close relationship with the Russian government. And the owner, Eugene Kaspersky, graduated from the KGB-backed Institute of Cryptography, Telecommunications, and Computer Science. So, mm-hmm, you know.
Yeah. Apparently NPR uses their software, but a former senior U.S. intelligence official said, I wouldn't put their stuff on my computer if you paid me. And then, interestingly enough,
yes,
they also had, Kaspersky Lab had paid Michael Flynn over $10,000 in 2015 for cybersecurity consulting. That's not the focus of the FBI questioning, but it's still very interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, how many coincidences can you have before you're like, there's something fucking here?
Yeah, definitely. So we're excited to welcome our guest for today. Mm-hmm. Saira Hussain is a staff attorney in the Criminal Justice Reform Program at Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Asian Law Caucus, where she advocates for immigrant rights through policy advocacy, litigation, and coalition building. Saira started her work at the Asian Law Caucus as a fellow in their immigrant rights program, where she defended immigrants in deportation proceedings. She graduated from UC Berkeley with a bachelor's degree in public health in 2009, received her JD from Cal in 2013, and was recently profiled in Teen Vogue, where she was described as, quote, an unsung hero for immigrants in the sanctuary city movement. Welcome to Hellbent, Saira.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, people might not know, but Saira and I know each other from Berkeley, and we participated in the same internship program in DC back in 2008. And I feel like the best way for us to catch up is to, you know, have you on our podcast.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think? Better than a coffee date, right?
Definitely. I had no idea, because Saira, you and I kind of fell out of touch for a little bit.
Right.
And then we reconnected on Twitter,
mm-hmm,
through somebody who happened to, like, retweet something I did.
Yes, yes.
And that was amazing. So Twitter brings people together.
I know.
It does.
There's some beautiful aspects of Twitter.
Yeah.
A lot of ugly aspects. But
it's
then
so beautiful.
Yeah, I was like, oh, I know this Saira Hussain. She's awesome. And she's just as much of a badass as I thought she'd be.
Cool.
Yeah. But Saira, we really, you know, we wanted to talk to you. We wanted to get you on the podcast because of your work. And it's so funny because when I reached out to you, I had no idea about the Teen Vogue article, and then it came out later, and I was like, wow, what an opportune, like, time to ask Saira to be, mm-hmm, on. So first of all, have you always wanted to be a lawyer, or is there a particular moment or sort of a mosaic of experiences that led you down this career path?
I did not know that I wanted to be an attorney growing up. And in fact, I didn't really know any attorneys. My family came over from Pakistan when I was 3 years old. So I'm an immigrant. I'm Muslim and a woman of color. We grew up in a predominantly white suburb of the Bay Area. And, you know, I always felt like I didn't really belong per se. And I'm really glad that the area has diversified since. But you know, growing up, I really didn't know any attorneys, and so I didn't really know what my career path was going to be. But when I was in high school, September 11th happened, and that pretty much was the changing point of my world, at least. My parents, you know, felt like we were going to be targets. And so the day after September 11th, they sat me down and they said, you know, please be really careful. My dad used the words, you know, lay low about being a Muslim.
Wow.
I was one of, you know, only a handful of Muslim students in my high school. And so immediately after that, he went out and got the biggest American flag that he could find and put it up in our living room window to say, you know, please don't target us.
Right.
Right.
So I went through high school, the Iraq War started, and I felt really outraged, but I didn't know how to channel that outrage. And, you know, I was pretty politically involved, but I didn't really know what else I could do. And then when I was in college, I had the opportunity to intern for a civil rights attorney who was working primarily with the AMEMSA community, Arab, Middle Eastern, Muslim, South Asian community, people who were targets of FBI investigations for no reason other than the fact that they were Muslim and happened to be brown. Mm-hmm. And people who were going through serious immigration issues and workplace discrimination. And that's pretty much when I figured out, you know, this is what I want to do. I want to devote my life to protecting civil rights. And so that started me down my path, and I couldn't be happier about taking that path.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Especially in this era too, I think.
Yeah.
The work you're doing is so crucial.
Yeah.
And I'm so impressed and amazed by you, which is why we wanted to have you on the podcast.
We really want to talk to you about your work at the Asian Law Caucus. What is the mission of the organization, and what does a typical day look like for you?
So the mission of our organization is to promote, advance, and represent the legal and civil rights of the Asian Pacific Islander community and other communities of color. We started out in 1972 as the first Asian American civil rights organization in the country.
Wow.
Started by a few scrappy students who just graduated from law school and said, you know, we really need a civil rights organization to represent our rights of our community. And thankfully, in the ensuing 45 years, we have expanded into 7 different program areas. We have a 3-prong model that really focuses on ensuring that everybody who comes through our doors are who informs our policy advocacy and our litigation strategies. So we really are from the grassroots to the ground up, and what we see on the ground is what we advocate for in the courts and in the state legislatures. And for me, every day looks so different. It just really depends on what's going on.
Yeah.
So I can tell you yesterday, for example, I was on several coalition calls related to statewide legislation, which I will talk about briefly. Then my organization held a brown bag lunch where we had a panel of formerly incarcerated immigrants, because oftentimes those voices are so silenced. So we wanted to bring folks in who've directly been through the incarceration and deportation systems, who could share their experiences with us and really talk about what the struggles were for many of these folks. And it was really an incredible panel. We were able to broadcast it through Facebook Live.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Yeah. And then a settlement that we had been working on, a proposed settlement, broke because it was on a public agenda in the city. And so we did several, I did several media interviews all throughout the afternoon with different media sources to talk about, you know, what this proposed settlement means. And it's in relation to San Francisco Sanctuary Ordinance. We were enforcing the ordinance to ensure that victims of crime were not being turned over to immigration, which is what happened to my client.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what yesterday looked like. Other days I'm in Sacramento lobbying for state legislation, or I'm in a mediation, or sometimes, you know, I'm just working on the ground in coalition spaces to figure out what we can push, what kind of policies we can push locally. Like last week, our Bay Area Rapid Transit, which is our public transportation system here in the Bay Area, passed their sanctuary in transit policy, which is the first public transportation system to pass a sanctuary policy. And so we were able to go and speak about that and you know, provide input and help craft that policy. So every day is an adventure. it's been really wonderful.
So not super busy.
No.
Just like a totally chill, super low key. And that's actually what I was curious about. And you sort of touched upon it. It's like the specific ways in which you fight for immigrant rights. It sounds like a lot. It's through litigation. It's through lobbying. Is that sort of by design, or is it just sort of how it happens?
It's definitely by design. Like I said, our three-prong model is to ensure that people who are coming in and seeking our services at the ground level, so whether it's housing or whether it's immigration, we have attorneys who go into immigration detention facilities several times a month in order to conduct sort of know your rights workshops and also just gather people's stories and figure out, okay, how are you being turned over to immigration? What's your story? What's happening? And that's how we track patterns to see, okay, this is a particular problem. For example, one of our major pieces of litigation, which is probably going to go before the Supreme Court next term, involves mandatory detention. So under the Immigration and Nationality Act, there is a certain provision that says if somebody has certain convictions for crimes, they can be held for mandatory detention, meaning that they do not receive a bond hearing. So basically, if immigration picks them up, they are immediately in custody and they cannot bond out, which is a huge due process problem. And so we challenge the mandatory detention statute by saying if there's a gap between criminal custody and immigration custody, then we believe that mandatory detention doesn't apply. And so one of our plaintiffs, for example, he had a possession of marijuana conviction, and he spent several years living his life before ICE came to his door one day and said, "We're taking you into custody. You're in mandatory detention now," right?
Wow.
So it became this huge, we kept seeing this as a huge problem. And so luckily the district court agreed with our interpretation of the statute. The Ninth Circuit affirmed it. The Ninth Circuit en banc, meaning, you know, a much larger panel, mm-hmm. affirmed it. And now the government has filed a writ of certiorari for the Supreme Court to hear it.
Wow.
So, you know, it's sort of like we see it on the ground. Yeah. We make sure that all of the advocacy we do afterward is what's following what we see directly on the ground.
That's incredible.
That is incredible. So, you know, Obama was known as the deporter in chief. So did the election of Trump change the nature of your work all that much? And if so, kind of in what ways? Like, what's changed?
Yeah, so you're right. Obama was known as the deporter in chief. And once Trump was elected, we just knew it was going to get worse.
Right.
Obama had said that he wanted to go after quote unquote felons, not families, which was a hugely problematic false dichotomy, because people who have felonies also have families. They're not, you know,
it's not either or.
Exactly. And when we as a nation have been recognizing the harms that our criminal justice system has wrought upon communities of color in particular, it's like that there was a completely separate conversation when it came to immigrants who had convictions, right? And so it was just so problematic to see what the policies were carried out by the Obama administration, who deported about 2.5 million people, which is more than any other president in history. And so when Trump came into office, he took that even further, because he was talking about, you know, felons, not families, but moreover said that he wanted to deport 11 million people. And he castigated whole communities as being unworthy of being here, and among really horrific other things that I'm not going to repeat on this podcast that he said.
Right.
And so within immigrant communities, there was an immediate fear. So after the election, we started receiving calls from parents who were afraid to send their kids to school, mm-hmm. parents who were reporting ICE sightings. So they were saying, mm-hmm. you know, there's a van on the corner. It hasn't been there before. I think it may be immigration. Mm-hmm. And that's how panic often spread through immigrant communities, because people were by word of mouth saying, I've seen immigration here. I've seen immigration at our grocery stores. I've seen them here. And you know, in many of these cases, it was false reports, and we were happy to go check it out and make sure that it wasn't valid, and then spreading that information through the community. But you know, the fear is palpable, and for good reason too, because the rhetoric now is that we're going to come after you. And the ICE director a couple of weeks ago said, none of you should feel safe. You know, that just that language in itself does so much harm to the communities among us, including the immigrant community. So one of the major things I want to also point out is that in Los Angeles, there's an LA Times article that I think came out in March or April, but they reported a 25% decrease in reports of sexual assaults and a 10% decrease in reports of domestic violence among the Latinx community, because the fear is so palpable. Yeah. It's not like they've tackled those issues all of a sudden.
Right? Yeah, and I've seen other cities report similar statistics. And, you know, just from a sort of community safety point of view, it, you know, going unfairly targeting immigrant communities makes the community as a whole less safe, because they're not as likely to trust or talk to police when something, you know, when a crime happens. So even like from that perspective, I think that's really important to bring up. Sort of along those lines, though, you know, in terms of sanctuary cities, what legal challenges do municipalities face when they do become sanctuary cities, and how far can they really go in practice to protect immigrant communities?
So, you know, sanctuary cities are something that came about in the 1980s under the Reagan administration, because there were asylum seekers fleeing genocide and war, civil wars in Central America, coming here with valid asylum claims. And because the U.S. government was providing aid to many of the dictators in those countries and propping up those governments, many of these asylum claims were denied under the Reagan administration. Oh. And so it started with churches at the border, particularly in Arizona, that said, you know what, we are going to be sanctuary congregations where people can come and seek refuge from persecution. And so people started entering those churches and seeing them as sort of safe spaces for them to be. And then soon after, cities started adopting those policies to say, we will not discriminate based on immigration status when it comes to providing services to residents of our city. And so San Francisco was one of the first sanctuary cities passed in 1989, and that's where I work. So, you know, that's sort of the backdrop to the history. And then come 2016 and this presidential election, all of a sudden it just explodes again when it talks about sanctuary city, when it had been dormant for about the last almost 30 years. And, you know, Trump is the one who's inflaming many of the hostilities against immigrants and talking about sanctuary cities. So when you're talking about what sort of legal challenges municipalities face, you know, any challenges to sanctuary cities usually have been, for the most part, been struck down.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Why? Is because the tenant.
Hold on. Sorry.
Is it cutting off?
Yeah, I was cutting off.
That's okay. No, don't worry about it. Can you just start from...
Struck the...
Yeah, you could just from legal challenges municipalities face.
Okay. Let me find my place again.
No worries. No worries.
So in terms of legal challenges, there's not much that cities face aside from potentially being sued. And in the majority of cases, courts have found that it is within the purview of cities to decide if they want to be sanctuary cities or not. So to adopt certain policies to say they're going to limit collaboration between local law enforcement and ICE, immigration. And so, you know, one of the things that people seemingly don't understand around sanctuary cities is that, you know, we have this sort of dual system where we have the states and we have the federal government, right? So if a sanctuary city declares that that their local law enforcement will not be working with immigration, they can't wholly prohibit immigration from coming into the community, right? So under the Bush administration, there was a program started called Secure Communities. And that program was expanded to all jails in 2013. But it started out by saying that once a person is booked into a local jail, their fingerprints will be taken and sent across several databases, including that of immigration. And so immigration would then come back with what's known as an immigration hold to say, we will, jail, please hold this person for up to 48 hours past the release. pass the release from criminal custody so that we can come and take custody of them. Now that is full of constitutional violations, and federal courts have found that to be the case in the past few years. But this is how people were being picked up. And so, you know, even if local law enforcement is not working with immigration, oftentimes there are already systems in place that force that collaboration to take place. So, you know, even in sanctuary cities, you can't prohibit the fingerprints from being sent across to these databases, including that of immigration. So I just think that there's a lot of misinformation when it comes to sanctuary cities and exactly how much, what the parameters of them are, as well as, you know, sort of what it actually means to be a sanctuary city.
Yeah,
definitely. Absolutely. So if you could have a magic wand, what kind of immigration policies would you implement on the state, local, and federal levels right now?
Oh, this is such a good question. I love questions that ask me to sort of dream beyond what we have in place, and rather than just sticking to, you know, defending the policies we have, and especially since that's what a lot of us have been doing now in the Trump era.
Right.
So, you know, I think federally, one of the major issues that has led to so many deportations is also the fact that deportations are intrinsically linked to the criminal justice system, right? So for the most part, what's happening is people are entering jails and they're never coming out of them, because what happens is there's a direct transfer once the person is finished with criminal custody, or even while the person is still in criminal custody, over to immigration. And it presents such a huge problem, because when you think about it, somebody has served their time. They've been deemed to have done their time, paid their debt to society, and that they're free to go back into society. And then the immigration system swoops in and says, wait. You are not free to go. We are now going to take custody of you, and we will start to initiate your deportation. So many people don't understand that in the immigration system, there is very little due process. People who are undergoing deportation proceedings are not guaranteed the right to an attorney.
Right. Wow.
If they can afford an attorney, they can pay for one. But the vast majority of people are going through the immigration system completely unrepresented or representing themselves.
Wow. Yeah, and I think in New York, they just passed something that guarantees attorneys for undocumented immigrants. But
that's right. Yeah, they did. And New York actually has this amazing project that started a few years back where they were New York City itself was providing attorneys to every immigrant who was in deportation proceedings. And then they expanded that to New York State, which is such a huge accomplishment.
Yeah.
We in California are trying to work on our own version of that. But, you know, California is where about 1/3 of immigration proceedings are taking place. And so it is, it's really hard to represent all the people who need that assistance.
Sure.
And, you know, for many of the clients that we serve here at the Asian Law Caucus, these are folks who are permanent residents, as in green card holders.
Wow.
They came to the country at the age of like 2, 3, 4 and ended up, coming here as refugees, mostly from Southeast Asia, fleeing from communist Vietnam or Laos or Cambodia. And when they came to this country, they were resettled into very poverty-stricken and violent environments. And so, you know, many of them at the age of like 13, 14, 15 started joining gangs in order to provide some sort of protection for them, because there was really nobody around to protect them, and tons of violence and discrimination. And then by the age of 16, 17 years old, they had been involved in some sort of, you know, violent encounter with rival gang members and sentenced then to life in prison.
Mm.
You know, many of the folks who have life sentences, they can go before the parole board at a certain point. So after serving something like 2 decades in prison, they're coming out and then finding out that they're going to be deported to a country they have never been to. Because many of these people were born in refugee camps in another country.
Mm-hmm.
And so now, you know, the U.S. government is trying to deport them after they've served their time, after they've been, you know, deemed eligible for release by the parole board and the governor. And then, you know, possibly being deported to countries they've never been right. to, have no family in, don't even know the language.
Right.
So it just really shows, you know, the complexities of our immigration system and just just who it affects and how it affects people.
Yeah. So yeah. You would really want to tackle the criminalization of immigration and really be able, like, if you could, like Devin said, wave a magic wand, mm-hmm. like really reform that aspect.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's one of the really major things. I feel like the fact that the two are so intrinsically connected has just led to these really terrible separations of families and just very unfair immigration policies that we have set out in this country. I think that another thing that is really important, especially at the local level, because most of the time when I work on issues, it's right now, there's nothing going to be moving at the federal government yeah. that's good, right?
Yep.
So most of my efforts are focused on local or state. Mm-hmm. And luckily in California, we do have folks who are ready to fight against the criminalization of immigrants. So, you know, at the local level, it really is not just about advancing sanctuary policies and making sure that our local law enforcement is focusing on local issues and not carrying out deportations, but also the fact that, you know, like I said, criminalization leads to immigration consequences. And so when we're talking about criminalizing quality of life offenses, or, you know, like, for example, in New York, I know one of the major pushes was if people jump a turnstile and they're taken to a local jail, they could be then turned over to immigration through the Secure Communities program, right?
Yeah, right.
So it's really talking about that our sanctuary policies at the local level don't just talk about immigration issues in a vacuum, but really connect the immigration issues with the criminalization pieces that are going on and ensuring that we're looking at ways to decriminalize rather than increase penalties.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
In terms of state legislation, I know that there's a bill, SB 54, in California. So can you sort of take us through that bill and your work in lobbying on behalf of it? And also along the same lines, like, what arguments do you use against people who do not support these types of legislations?
Sure. So SB 54 is a bill that we're really excited about here. My organization has been working with a coalition of other organizations around the state to really push forward this bill. And it's being led by the pro tem of the Senate, Kevin De Leon, here in California. So the bill itself it has two major parts. The first part is that it essentially says that our local law enforcement will not be enforcing federal immigration laws, that our resources should be used to, you know, for public safety purposes in our local communities and not to help the federal government. And so it in a lot of ways, it tries to break some of the ties that immigration has used and sort of slithered in there to try to get local law enforcement to work on. The federal government immigration agents, there's only about a few thousand immigration agents. And so Jeff Sessions has said that he wants to use local law enforcement agents to sort of be a force multiplier to carry out deportations, right? Because local law enforcement's in every community, immigration's not in every community.
Yeah, right.
So that's one of the major pieces of what SB 54 tries to address. The second piece is that it tries to look at public spaces like libraries, schools, hospitals, and healthcare facilities to ensure that there are privacy policies in place. And making sure that, you know, people's information, private information, is not being turned over to the federal government. For example, you know, things around their home address, their personal information, immigration status, things like that. And so it really does try to create these sort of safe zones to ensure that that anybody, regardless of immigration status, can access services that local governments offer.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a great bill that's moving forward. And one of the biggest and just omnibus pro-immigrant pieces of legislation around the country. So
yeah.
We are really excited about that. And then for people, you know, of course, there are folks who do not support the legislation. And for those folks, I really think that there's some very interesting arguments that generally are co-opted by the right. That they've been using. So under the 10th Amendment, the federal government cannot commandeer local resources to carry out the federal government's job. And so the Supreme Court has already ruled on this back in 1997 in a case called Prince versus the United States, where the federal government passed a law requiring local law enforcement to conduct background checks on people who wanted to buy handguns. And so the federal government, the Supreme Court said, you know, you cannot use local resources, meaning sheriffs and police, in order to conduct these background checks. And the same reasoning was used in striking down a small portion of the Affordable Care Act in 2012, which where the federal government was trying to take away existing Medicaid funds if states refused to participate in the Medicaid expansion. And they said, you know, you can't commandeer local resources. The Supreme Court said it. So funny enough, this has been used, like I said, by the right for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And the underlying theme is that of states' rights, right? States can decide how to use their resources.
Right.
But states' rights cuts both ways.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so now when you see local law enforcement saying that they don't want to participate in helping the federal government carrying out deportations, because Sarah, like you mentioned, it reduces public safety, people become scared of reporting crimes. Then you see this blowback all of a sudden, where people like Jeff Sessions are saying, no, the federal government should be able to decide and commandeer resources, right?
You're like, I see your hypocrisy, dude. I see you. So, like, you really like states' rights when it was about all these other things. And then that's a really great point, Sarah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's been really, really fascinating to see how this plays out. You do see the people's sort of head spin, being like, wait, this can't be the same argument. And it is. It's the same argument.
Right. Sure. So to close out every episode, we do a gratitude check to sort of take stock of the good things that are happening personally or within the country or the world. So what's something that you're especially grateful for right now?
And it could be anything.
It could
be
anything.
We've had people say, like, Netflix streaming. Like, I am so grateful for Netflix streaming.
Which I am.
Hard agree.
Yeah.
I am too.
Yeah.
But I actually do have a really fun one. And it is on the theme of immigrant rights because it's not the only thing I think about, but, you know.
It occupies a big part of your brain.
Yeah.
It does.
That makes sense.
It does. And rightfully so.
Yes.
I'm a huge Hamilton fan.
Ooh, yeah.
I don't know if either of you have been able to see the play.
I'm seeing it in August.
Oh, awesome.
I'm so excited.
I luckily got to see it here in March. But my organization, the Asian Law Caucus, was lucky enough to be selected as one of the organizations in the coalition called Immigrants, We Get the Job Done. And so it's 12 organizations, and Lin-Manuel Miranda created this challenge called the Ham for All Challenge.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Ham for All. And he challenges celebrities and regular folks to donate to the coalition and to enter for a chance to win 2 tickets to the LA premiere of Hamilton and then VIP access party fun fancy things. And then people are supposed to sing a small part of Hamilton. And so if you follow the hashtag, you see people like Steph and Aisha Curry and Eva Longoria and other great people who are taking part in this Ham for All challenge. And then yesterday, to promote the campaign, Lin-Manuel dropped the music video to Immigrants, We Get the Job Done from the Hamilton mixtape. And it is everything. It has like really great people in it, including Riz Ahmed, who I'm a huge fan of. So it was just so gratifying to see, you know, that. And I watched it like on loop over and over again.
Yeah.
That's a great gratitude.
That's a great one.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
Yeah.
Very on topic.
Yeah.
Like,
and also fun.
And also very fun.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is a great note to close off on. So thank you to Saira Hussain for joining us today on Hellbent. You can follow her on Twitter, and I very highly encourage you to. You can follow her at SairaHussain87. You can also follow Asian Americans Advancing Justice, Asian Law Caucus at AAAJ_ALC. So thank you, Saira.
Thank you.
Thank you for talking to us today.
Thanks so much.
All right, that was an amazing interview. I know I say this every time, but one of my favorites, but she was so smart.
I mean, everyone we get to talk to is just brilliant. And
really?
It truly, like, it's, we feel very honored to get to talk to such, you know, smart people, especially smart women.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's the best part of doing this. So, all right, let's get into our gratitude check.
Yeah.
So, Sarah, what are you grateful for?
Well, first of all, I love Syra's gratitude check.
Yes.
She had a great one.
She did.
About Hamilton and all that stuff. But the first thing I'm grateful for are mayors.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so just mayors in general.
mayors.
But specifically, mayors of 7,400 cities, they have vowed to meet Obama's climate commitments.
Oh, you're right. Mayors are great.
Mayors are great. So at the first meeting of a, quote, global covenant of mayors, city leaders from across the U.S., Europe, and elsewhere pledged to work together to keep the commitments made by Barack Obama 2 years ago in terms of the Paris Accord.
Right.
So cities will devise a standard measurement of emission reductions to help them monitor their progress. They will also share ideas for delivering carbon-free transport and housing. So this sort of first meeting of this group of mayors came after Michael Bloomberg announced on Monday an investment of $200 million over the next 3 years in U.S. cities, able to illustrate a commitment to reducing emissions. So really you're seeing sort of from the ground up.
Right, right.
From local governments and communities and, you know, clearly philanthropists and
right.
business leaders like Michael Bloomberg. They're like, fuck you, Trump.
Fuck you.
We're still going to do this shit. and Kasim Reed, who's the mayor of Atlanta, said, quote, "My firm belief is that that President Trump's disappointing decision to withdraw from the agreement will actually have the opposite effect in terms of execution. We have the ability to still achieve between 35% and 45% CO2 emission reductions without the involvement of the national government. And it is why I chose to be here at this time to send a signal to 7,400 cities around the world that now should be a time of optimism, passion, and action." And then Gregor Robertson, who's the mayor of Vancouver,
okay,
he said, quote, "The Trump administration better watch out for U.S. cities. They are on the rise, and I think they will prevail in the end. Turning the tide and making sure the U.S. is a climate leader rather than what is currently happening." So I just love this.
Yeah.
I'm like, yes, thank you, mayors.
I know. That is so great. Especially because climate change, with so much else going on, it's kind of flying under the radar in a lot of ways.
And, like, we just don't have a lot of time to, you know,
right.
to sit back and not do anything.
Exactly.
And watch Trump, like, continue to erode some of the progress that is trying to be made.
Absolutely. So I love that these mayors are standing up.
Me too. So big gratitude check there. And then the second thing I'm grateful for is a woman named Susanna Reed. She shaded Piers Morgan so brilliantly yesterday that I'm still kind of recovering from
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah. This made me so fucking happy too.
It was amazing. So her, Morgan, and Charlotte Hawkins all co-host Good Morning Britain, and Piers was, like, complaining about people getting political on Facebook.
Which is my least favorite complaint on Facebook.
Especially in this era.
Yeah, it's like, come on.
Come on. Like, this is like, such a crucial time.
Like, everybody calm the fuck down. Okay?
Like, fuck off.
Fuck off.
Yeah,
like, let me live my life.
You can post your puppy pictures. That's fine.
That's fine.
And sometimes maybe I will. But if I want to talk about politics on Facebook, you can unfollow me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's super easy.
It's super easy. Anyway, so Pierre said, quote, "I get annoyed when people can't stop banging on about politics on Facebook. It really annoys me. I've had to unfriend family members. I need some respite. Can you put a picture of your little kid having an ice cream?" And then Susanna Reed, in response to him, like, totally deadpanned with, "I know what you mean. When someone just keeps going on and you just need respite and a break, you wish you could defriend them, but you're just forced to listen to their views. I know exactly how you feel."
That's amazing.
And reading the quotes out loud does not do the video justice because, like, Susanna Reed is clearly out of fucks.
Love
like,
it.
She just can't find them. She's like, where are these fucks?
Fucks. They're gone.
They're gone.
Bye.
And when Piers Morgan is just sitting there recognizing in real time that she is shading the hell out of him, like, on live TV, it is just so beautiful. And as at V. Mochama said on Twitter, quote, "Shading men who are right beside you is a form of feminist warfare."
It is.
And I just loved it. And it, like, seriously gave me so much life.
I know.
And honestly, she's, like, a Maxine Waters Award, like, runner-up, I think.
Seriously.
We didn't put her in the section, but I think we can say honorary mention.
Oh, absolutely. She was amazing.
All right, Devin, so what are you grateful for today?
Okay, I have a really long, another personal story. I know I'm always the one that gets into savvy personal stories.
I love it.
But, like, I use this podcast as therapy, so.
You know what? Like, you inspire me to do the same.
Yeah, so
like
it's fun. I mean, there's a lot of political shit going on, but so I only have one for today, and I was going to do it on Monday, but I wanted to collect my thoughts a little bit. So it's Harry Potter, because the 20th anniversary
right.
of the first book was on Monday. And I want to give you a little personal backstory because I'm me and, you know,
sure. I need to do. You have a podcast. You're like, I can say whatever the fuck I want.
Whatever the fuck I want. You have to listen. You don't have to listen, but, you know.
But I have to listen.
But yeah, you do.
That was directed at me.
It was. So, all right. So in the late summer of 1997, my family moved to Los Angeles from the San Francisco area.
Which I just want to say, again, first heartbreak of my life.
Right. Because we were
best
besties.
Friends. Yep.
Yep. So my dad was given a job opportunity that he couldn't pass up. So my dad's new job involved him traveling for up to 6 or 8 weeks at a time. And he would, like, bring us back little trinkets and, you know, it was really cool. But basically...
So, like, lots of international, big international trips.
Lots of big international trips. So, basically, my mom was dropped off in a new house in a new city with 4 children. I was 9. My sister was 7. My little sister was 3. And my brother was 1.
Right.
And they,
that's intense.
Yeah. With no family. All my extended family lives in Michigan and no friends. So this is when my mom started drinking.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. You know, it wasn't horrible or unmanageable at first. It was just she was involved in our lives and she took good care of us, but she was just really stressed and lonely, which, I mean, looking back on it now, I totally get.
Right.
But over the next 4 years or so, it got to the point where my mom would, like, pass out in her chair every night and sometimes not make it to her bedroom, so we'd find her there in the morning.
Mm.
In 1999, my sister, Tegan, was given the second Harry Potter book as a birthday present.
Oh.
And we both read it, and we realized that it was a series, and we became obsessed. And we each thought we were going to be accepted to Hogwarts.
Oh, yeah, of
any
course.
Moment.
I still believe that.
I know. There's, like, a part of me.
I'm like, where's the portal to Hogwarts?
I know.
Take me there.
So... as my home life got worse, I got more involved with the Harry Potter series.
Kind of like an escape.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So my sister and I would, like, dress up.
Aww.
And we'd, like, play. We had, like, these wands. We would write fan fiction.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So
we made fan art.
Aww.
Which I'm going to put some up on the website.
Yes.
It's really bad.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Since we all love Harry Potter, you guys, you friends might like to see that. We went to every book launch and then every movie premiere dressed up. And we had these elaborate fan theories for what came next, and we read them to our younger siblings.
Aww.
Yeah. My most precious possessions are my original set of Harry Potter books.
Yeah.
And the one that Tegan, my sister, got as a present was actually a misprint. It's actually quite valuable now.
Oh, it's like those, like, fucked up Beanie Babies?
Yeah.
And, like, that had, like, random shit missing.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, that's worth, like, $800 on the black market.
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, I talked about Harry Potter in my wedding vows. Like, I'm serious.
You're real, like, in deep there.
Yeah. So, I mean, and, you know, everyone's like, I was like Hermione. But, like, I was like Hermione.
You in, really identified with her.
Yes, in some ways. I mean, I was smart and bossy and, like, not particularly remarkable looking. And I had big teeth and, like, I was kind of goofy and I was secretly very sensitive. And I would cry and then ask myself what Hermione would do. And then side note, I don't know if anyone was on the fanfiction websites circa 2005, but if you were, I believe in trees. And if you know what that means, please tweet at me.
I have no idea what that means.
I know you don't. You don't even know who Scorpius Malfoy is. Like, let's all calm down.
Ron, I still stand by that Ron is fucking useless.
Well, Ron was the first boy I wanted to marry. So
fuck you, Sarah.
Fuck you, Sarah. I believe in trees. You know, she was my first female role model.
Yeah.
My second was McGonagall.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And my first daughter... should I ever have one, will be named Minerva.
Ooh.
My husband knows this, and he's like, I'm not okay with it. I'm like, I don't really care.
You don't have a choice in this.
Yeah, because Minerva McGonagall is the baddest bitch in literature.
She's really, yeah, she's amazing.
So those books got me through a tough home life that looked picture perfect on the outside, but was rotting from the inside out.
Mm-hmm.
Without those books, I would not be doing this podcast. I would not have the endurance to have gotten out of a bad situation. I mean, I read those books biblically.
Yeah.
I would not be the person I am today. And I know that Harry Potter changed a lot of people's lives, but Harry Potter saved mine in, like, a lot of ways.
Mm.
Because at the core, it's about being brave against monsters, be they Voldemort or spiders or bipolar disorder or Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And I am brave today because a smart, bossy girl with big teeth let me escape into her for just a moment, and she gave me the strength to fight the monsters I face today.
That is really beautiful. I love that.
Okay, Sarah, so let's get into the Maxine Waters update and the Maxine Waters Award in badassery. Great way to end the week.
Yes. So let's start with some fire tweets.
Yeah.
From our queen, Maxine.
Yes.
Yeah. I feel like we could all use a lesson in speaking truth to power. Like,
oh, absolutely.
The honorable Maxine Waters.
The Honorable Maxine Waters.
Congresswoman.
Her tweets are so fucking good.
They're just, like, really get to the heart of the matter,
they
feel like.
They really do.
So the first thing she tweeted that we wanted to make note of, she said, quote, "No Comey tapes, no Obama wiretapping, no evidence against Susan Rice, no tax returns, and 5 months in, still no clue how to be president." Which is, like, just a perfect summation of this, like, bullshit sham of a president.
Right, right. Yeah. And all those scandals he keeps trying to throw out into the press. Yeah. Like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah. And then she tweeted after, you know, the disability rights activists were protesting in front of McConnell's office and were being ripped from their wheelchairs. She said, quote, "Instead of disabled people in wheelchairs, the only person who should be dragged anywhere is Trump down the hall to impeachment." Which I'm like, Maxine, I am ready for impeachment.
Seriously.
You said get ready for impeachment a couple months ago, and I'm ready.
I am ready.
My
right
body
now.
Is ready.
Let's do it.
And then let's also talk about the town hall she had in Gardena about healthcare while protesters rallied outside the event.
Yes. So, you know, she basically criticized key members of President Trump's cabinet, including Betsy DeVos, Sessions, Tillerson, and she said that the housing secretary, Ben Carson, should go back to being a surgeon, and she will, quote, "take him apart when he goes before the House Committee on Financial Services," as where she's the ranking Democrat.
I bet she will.
I'm honestly popcorn.
Yeah, ready to
just go.
To eat the popcorn.
And so this event was actually held before the CBO score was released.
Right.
But,
and the CBO score was released after we finished recording on Monday.
Right.
So we didn't get to talk about it then.
Right. Mm-hmm. But she did spoke about how this bill needs to basically die a horrible, fiery death. and how she had hope that there may be Republican senators that will vote against it, especially after the CBO score came out.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in the action items. But yeah, basically the bill, we thought, you know, Mitch McConnell really wanted a vote before July 4th, and it looked like he didn't have enough, he didn't shore up enough support from Republicans, so they're delaying it. So we'll have some more information and action items later.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get into our Maxine Waters Award in Badassery. We have a few honorable mentions, and as I mentioned in my gratitude check, Susanna Reid is definitely in there.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, shading Piers Morgan on live TV and giving zero fucks.
While he's sitting next to her.
That's like goals for me.
Seriously. Like, that's not even like a Twitter shade. That's like to your face.
Yeah. So honestly, like, all these people could win the award.
They really could.
They really could. But our first honorable mention is Serena Williams.
Yes.
She responded to John McEnroe's bullshit comments, like, really well. So first of all, John McEnroe was, like, on NPR, and they were talking about Serena Williams.
Right.
And he was like, definitely, like, the like one of the best, like, he said, the best female player, tennis player of all time.
Right.
And the interviewer asked, basically, like, why did you feel like I need to caveat it with, like, gender?
Right.
He was like, he basically said, like, she would be, like, ranked 700th on the men's tour, so, like, we can't say she's, like, the best player of all time. That was, like, the implication.
Right. What he said, and I want to be precise about this because it's such a bullshit thing.
Yeah.
He said, quote, "Maybe at some point a woman's tennis player can be better than anybody. I just haven't seen it in any other sport, and I haven't seen it in tennis. I suppose anything's possible at some stage."
And a lot of people correctly pointed out on Twitter, why is the measure of greatness, why is it always defaulted to men?
Right.
That you would have to hypothetically be a man.
Right.
Because Serena Williams, like, has, if I'm not mistaken, like, 23 Grand Slams.
Yeah.
Like, her list of accomplishments and her dominance in the sport.
Yeah.
And she has said multiple times before, if I were a man, I would be considered, like, the greatest tennis player ever.
Of all time.
And I agree.
Yeah. Oh,
and a
absolutely.
Lot of people agreed. So anyway, we loved her response especially, because I like to describe it as, like, the most polite way to be like, please excuse me from your bullshit narrative.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So she tweeted, "Dear John, I adore and respect you, but please, please, please keep me out of your statements that are not factually based." Which I love. It's not. She is the greatest player of all time.
She really is.
One of the best athletes of all time.
Yeah.
And then did you see also her Vanity Fair shoot when she was naked and pregnant?
Pregnant,
and then those, like, beautiful photos of her and her fiancé.
Yes.
Like, very, just so beautiful. And I was like, Serena Williams is living her best life.
I
and, like,
know.
John McEnroe is, like, a sad has-been.
I know. When I was pregnant, I really wanted to do photos like that. But then I was like, that's not what I'm going to look like. All right. So also, while I have been yelling over on Twitter about the press secretary's degradation of norms of free press,
yeah,
of all publications, Playboy
Playboy has joined the resistance.
Yeah, Playboy went out and did something about it.
Yeah. Like, Merriam-Webster.
We are living in the upside down.
But I think that they've had someone covering politics for a while.
No, they have.
So it's not that out of the ordinary.
No,
but this moment was incredible.
Well, right. It's not that they haven't been covering politics, is that it's
this moment
that they stood up.
Yeah.
So Sarah Huckabee Sanders went on some rant about anonymous sources. And Brian Karem from Playboy basically told her off.
Yeah, like in the middle of a press briefing.
Yeah. And, you know, he said, I'm going to quote it, and it's really, I'm not going to do it justice. You have to watch this video.
Yeah.
But he said, quote, any one of us are replaceable. And any one of us, if we get it wrong, the audience has the opportunity to turn the channel or not read us. You've been elected to serve for 4 years at least. There's no option other than that. We're here to ask you questions. You're here to provide answers. And what you just did is inflammatory to people all over the country who look at it and say, see, once again, the president is right and everyone else out here is fake media, and everybody in this room is only trying to do their job.
Yeah, it was a pretty remarkable moment.
It really was.
Yeah, really, and standing up for the press and press freedom and saying, like, listen, you're a public servant.
Right.
So this is, like, inappropriate
right.
for you to be doing this.
Right, your job is to answer our questions.
Yep, exactly. So that was awesome. Our next honorable mention, who really I feel like could have been the winner this week.
It was,
like,
a toss-up.
It's really a toss-up.
Honestly, this could be a tie between this one and
our next story. But ADAPT activists, so we had talked about them on the last podcast because they were protesting in front of Mitch McConnell's office. So ADAPT activists in Colorado staged a 34-hour-plus sit-in at Senator Cory Gardner's Denver office. And it's an important statement. One of the most famous ADAPT protests was in Colorado. And that's where activists slept in front of buses in order to gain accessibility. Like, you know, if you take a bus today, you notice that all of them are accessible.
Right.
They weren't always like that.
Nope.
Like, these disability rights activists had to fight for it.
Right.
They were literally sleeping in front of buses.
Right. So they couldn't move because they said, we're paying for these buses.
And we are not able to
use them.
Yeah. Our tax dollars are going into this.
Right.
And so that movement eventually led to the Americans with Disabilities Act, which was passed in 1990.
So
really not that long ago.
No.
Yeah. And so, you know, in this piece, they noted Colorado was the first state to adopt attendant services, which can include help with everything from bathing and toileting to cooking and cleaning. A year and a half ago, ADAPT started talking to Gardner about creating a national program that mirrors Colorado. So I'm assuming this is all around healthcare.
Yes.
And all this stuff. And so really, really inspiring stuff.
Yeah.
From this group of activists.
And especially, you know, Gardner, who's from Colorado, who ADAPT wants to get this program on a national level, and, you know, so he's saying he might vote for this.
And I think this is also around the healthcare bill.
Right, he might vote for this awful healthcare bill that would take away Medicaid.
Yeah, definitely. So, again, I feel like it's a tie between this and...
It really is.
Our next one, but just to finish up this story, you know, Jeff Stein from Vox had a great thread on what was happening in the office and had pictures... you know, he had asked, you know, a spokesperson, like, when are you leaving? And they said, however long it takes to get a no vote pledge. What if it doesn't? We'll stay until he removes us.
Yes.
And Kimberly Jackson, a former physician who had to stop her practice when she developed intestinal disease, you know, her care is covered by Medicaid, said, quote, the group will not become complacent because the vote was delayed. If anything, we have to double our efforts now that the bill was delayed, not back off. So, you know, let's celebrate the fact that they had to delay the vote.
Yeah.
That's a big win in sort of the moral sense.
Yes.
But, you know, we obviously have to redouble our efforts over July 4th recess and keep up the pressure. And again, we will have action items specific to that.
Right. So the winner, which again, this was really a tie.
Yeah.
It was basically a coin flip.
Yeah.
But let's say they tied.
Yeah.
So the winner was Senator Mazie Hirono of Hawaii.
Co-winner. Yeah.
She tweeted on Monday, June 26th. She said, quote, tomorrow I'm having surgery to treat my cancer. But tonight I'm with Senate Democrats opposing Trump care. So this is really, like, what resistance looks like.
Honestly, also, women never cease to amaze me.
I know.
She's like, I'm getting a surgery for cancer tomorrow, but first I'm going to take care of some business.
Right. It reminds me of when Feinstein.
Yes. Like, with her, like, heart surgery.
Yes.
And then, like, a couple days later was like, I'm back.
I'm back, and I'm going to fuck you up, basically. So even when shit is hard, and even when it feels like there's no end in sight, I mean, she just continues to show up.
Yeah.
And speak out. And we're all pulling for Senator Hirano and hope her surgery, which was related to a recently discovered kidney cancer, went well. But, you know, just kind of thank you to her for, yeah, in light of all of this, she still was like, you know what? I've got shit to do.
Yeah. And I mean, like, it would have been totally understandable for her, right, to say, I'm not healthy enough to. And that would have been totally
fine.
But she felt like she could still do it. And it's so pertinent to this healthcare debate.
Yes.
She's like, I'm currently sick.
Sick. Right. And so
fighting to save, you know, the ability for other sick people to get, you know, affordable and accessible treatment. All right, Devin, let's get into our action items. Mm-hmm. And first, I think we wanted to share one from Syra. So yes, she has a message for you Hellions that we're going to play right now.
If you live in California, I highly encourage you to contact your assembly member because SB 54, the California Values Act, which we spoke about earlier, is making its way through the state assembly. It's already gone through the Senate side and passed, and we really need a huge push to get it through the assembly and then before the governor's desk. So call your local state representative, your state assembly member. If you don't know who that is, you can look it up and contact that person. Just make sure you call often and voice your support for SB 54. The second thing is at the federal level, so everybody can do this. There are a couple of really harmful immigration bills that are passing through the House, and they're going to be voted on this week. And so, you know, in the face now of the failure to repeal Obamacare, now the House is turning their attention towards anti-immigrant bills. And of course, there hasn't been as loud of an outcry as there has been for saving ACA. There are two bills that are moving forward. One is called H.R. 3003, the No Sanctuary for Criminals Act, and then H.R. 3004, Kate's Law. And both of those are just really problematic bills that try to increase criminal penalties for people who are, you know, immigrants in this country and trying to live and survive and be with their families. And both of them have been you know, perceived by many, many law professors to violate the 10th Amendment and the 4th Amendment as well. So there are serious constitutional issues with both of these, and it really tries to force local law enforcement agencies to work with immigration to carry out deportations. And, you know, under states' rights arguments, they should be able to figure that out for themselves if they want to do that. So
right,
please contact your local representative and say that you want them to vote no on HR 3003 and HR 3004.
Yeah, and then for your local state representatives, you can use ourstates.org, which we plug all the time.
Yeah, ourstates.org, you can find your local reps.
Local reps.
And they don't get as many calls as your congressional reps.
They love to hear
from yes, you. Yes, they so really do love to hear from you. They're very accessible.
Yeah, yes.
Definitely. Okay, so awesome stuff from Syra.
Yes.
I'm so glad that we got her to do that. Mm-hmm. She was really excited that we had action items.
Yes.
Right? Yes. But we're going to go through some of our own.
Right.
We're obviously hyper-focused on healthcare as
right,
well. So Senate Republicans have actually pushed back the vote on the bill to repeal ACA. So when we were talking on Monday, we were like, you know, not sure what was going to happen. We thought the vote might come. But then the CBO score got released, and it was horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
So some sort of top line. Do you want to take us through some of those top line numbers?
Yes. So the CBO has said about the Senate version of this bill that 22 million people will be uninsured by 2026, and 15 million people could be uninsured as soon as next year.
Wow.
Under this bill. I just would like to point out, too, that the House version of this bill would have left 23 million people uninsured. So the GOP's senators' promises to revamp the House bill are bullshit.
Yeah, they're like, oh, we're totally going to write our own bill.
Right.
But the effect is very similar.
I mean, yeah.
Very craven.
Right. And the Senate bill actually cuts $772 billion with a B dollars from Medicaid over 10 years.
Yeah, so clearly when that stuff came out, it caused sort of the Republican caucus to not be totally shored up.
Right.
So McConnell, you know, he's delaying the vote because he knows he doesn't have the votes yet for this bill. So they're trying to, I guess, revise it. So, you know, I think this is a sign that the resistance is working, you know, and it happened because you called your Republican senators, you called your, you know, told them what you thought, what healthcare meant to you. You called your Democratic senators and told them to, like, fucking withhold consent and filibuster the shit out of this bill, filibuster by amendment. So just take a minute to really revel in that, and that, you know, people as a collective, we have power.
Yeah.
But the fight is not over.
No. I mean, I think now is the time for this tactical thinking that we've been talking about. The July 4th recess is the perfect time to talk to your senators and their aides in person. So show up, and if they're not holding town halls, go where they will be. So Topher Spiro put it nicely. Quote, they won't hold town halls, so go to where they will be. Parades, ribbon cuttings, their local offices, the airport. And it's just important to note that 34 out of 52 Republican senators haven't held a single town hall.
Yeah, I have a friend who is from Florida, and she's always like, I see you, Marco Rubio, like, dodging your constituents. And I will also point out, just from that Topher Spiro bit, like, go to where they are, especially, like, 4th of July events. They love a good 4th of July event.
Oh, yeah.
So really fuck some shit up for
them. Like, hang out.
They're trying to, like, you know, have this, like, good old patriotic time.
Yeah.
But tell them, like, listen, motherfucker, if you take away my health care, like,
no one's going to have a good time here.
Yeah. Especially not you.
Especially not you. But this is not to discourage you.
Yeah.
One of our fave Twitter follows, Oliver Willis.
Oh, yes. I love him.
He tweeted, quote, treat the Senate health care bill like the monster at the end of the movie that everybody assumes is dead.
Yeah. So sort of to underline that, like, you know, we have a mini win with the fact that they've delayed the vote.
Right.
But it's not done yet. It's not over. Keep pushing. Act like it's the monster at the end of the movie that people think is dead.
Like, with the hand, like, coming up out of the ground.
Yep.
To set up the sequel.
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, noted dickwad, Paul Ryan said that he thinks, quote, the left is out of gas. So let's prove him the fuck wrong.
Yeah.
The Indivisible Guide has a project called Trump Care 10. Mm-hmm. They also have a lot of other great resources. Like,
yes.
They have all the contact information for, like, the healthcare aides
for senators.
For senators. They have a tool, I think, where you can submit your own, like, amendment for, like, Democrats to filibuster by amendment. But this Trump Care 10 targets 10 states that have vulnerable Republican senators.
Yeah. So hellions, especially in Alaska, West Virginia, Maine, Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Louisiana, and Arkansas, can get all sorts of resources at TrumpCare10.org. to contact your senators. And they have these, like, digital toolkits with, like, shareable things for Twitter and Facebook and, like, how to contact. And then for hellions who aren't in one of those 10 states, if you go to TrumpCare10.org/other, they also have resources to help fight Trump Care, even if you don't have one of those senators.
Right.
So coordinated mass calls are what is going to stop this thing in its tracks.
Yeah, and I think we mentioned on the previous podcast that there's, you know, phone banking efforts.
Yes.
Like, California Cavalry is an example. The ACLU, Southern California, they were texting me about it. So look into that as well. So I think you can call people who are in different states, and especially those states where there are vulnerable Republicans, to remind them to call them.
Right.
So there's lots of stuff we can do. So yeah, I mean, this thing, I'm ready to kill this bill.
Me too.
Yeah.
It's ready to go.
Ready to go.
All right. Well, this is going to be our last episode. For a week.
That sounded so dramatic and final. Like, I was like,
gotta ramp up the drum. This is our, no, it's not our last episode. Are you kidding?
Yeah.
You can't get us to shut up.
But yes, Devin is right. Just a reminder, we will be off next week.
Yes.
But we will be back the following week. So have a great time on 4th of July. Be safe.
Yes.
Call your senators.
Call your senators. Show up.
Show up. Just raise hell.
Yes. And we will be around on social media.
Yeah.
So if you want to chat.
Yeah.
We'll be around.
Yeah.
We have lives, only sort of. So don't worry.
Yeah. But thank you again for listening, and we'll see you a week from now.
Yes. For more information on today's episode, please visit our website at www.hellbentpodcast.com. You'll find the articles we discussed, as well as additional resources. You can follow us on Twitter at HellbentPod, and you can follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/HellbentPodcast. You can follow Devin on Twitter at Devin Handy, and you can follow Sarah on Twitter at Sarah Lerner.
Please listen on iTunes and rate us 5 stars, because that's just like the rules of feminism. We also have a Patreon, and you can find us at patreon.com/hellbentpodcast. You can support us for as little as $1 a month, and for $5 a month, you get access to exclusive content, mini podcasts, and behind-the-scenes looks at the making of Hellbent. And there are lots of other fun rewards for higher levels of patronage, including a monthly Skype session with Devin and Sarah.
And for that one, drinking is optional.
Optional.
Quote, quote unquote. Thank you.